Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Roguecast episode 277, recorded November 12, 2019. If there's no British mutants, I'm not interested. It is cold.
You know, you say that, but the room that we're in, because of that we're in the office of the store, and it's like gathered the heat, and the door is closed, it's actually sort of warm in here. The sun's also coming in.
It's pleasant in here. I've got my t-shirt on and done my sweatshirt. It's nice.
Well, yeah, you're wearing a t-shirt. I'm wearing like sort of like a heavier
flannel shirt. All I can say is my sacrifice worked.
Why would you do this?
Because the cold is amazing.
Now, the cold was nice, like in its way, was a nice build up last night, Randy, to us going to Texas Chili Parlor.
Yeah, we took our annual trip to Texas Chili Parlor,
yep.
And we got chili.
Yeah, it was very delicious.
Perfect temperature.
And for sure, like, we need to, like, I think we determined we need to make it not just once a year.
Yeah.
Two, three times during the fall and winter seasons.
Yep.
In what is it still fall, right?
It is technically fall, yes.
Yeah. It just got exceptionally cold for Texas. So yeah, we'll have to do it again.
Yeah.
But yes, otherwise, it is icy cold, blizzard-like conditions, new ice age, glaciers impending.
Yep.
Mammoths on the loose, day after tomorrow, Hoth, chilly outside.
Yeah, this is all accurate. Also, it is fall TV season, and it's also getting already into the winter movie season, so we have a lot of stuff to talk about when we get to topics.
Yeah, not the least of which is the just happened early this morning in the wee hours of the morning debut of Disney Plus,
yep.
Which we're going to kind of like do a our first look at The Mandalorian, which they debuted with, which I guess all of our dumbasses were stayed up late to watch.
Actually, no, I felt I was getting tired halfway through, so I woke up early this morning to watch the rest of it.
Oh, I guess if you don't have to get the books in the morning, you got to watch.
Yeah,
in the
what
morning.
You do is you get a couple other suckers to do that for you.
Well, I guess that worked out great for you.
I think Randy posted at what 1:30 that Disney Plus is up.
It was like 12:30.
Was it?
Yeah, it wasn't that late.
Okay, I must have seen it around 1:30, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll download it, and then I watched it, so I didn't go to bed till like 3:30.
I went to bed earlier than either one of you, who had to be up like hours before me.
Uh-huh.
And then I got up in time that I could have come here and pulled books.
What are you, some kind of puppet master? Cruel puppet master?
I'm a monster is what I am.
But anyway, yes, I saw everybody on my social media feeds were all blabbing about The Mandalorian. Everybody who was up late to post on Facebook was also watching Mandalorian,
and voicing their frustrations that Disney Plus was not working for them
because everybody was watching.
Because over a million people were like, "Let's watch Disney Plus," and then their servers were like, "Ah!"
As I was watching, I believe I had only one glitch. But I also did not finish watching it because, like Randy, I was too tired, and at that point I was like, if I stay up much later, I'm gonna wreck myself tomorrow.
Yep.
But I did not have the morning thing to catch up. But I've got enough to have an opinion on. This world is nothing if not the world of hot takes.
Yes.
So.
All right. Before that, we got a little bit of news. We got that Netflix is doing The Unsound, which was that Cullen Bunn book about the mental health.
Yep. Actually, and I think you have to say The Unsound.
The Unsound. Not The Unsound.
Which was a thing in the Black Tapes?
Black Tapes programming. Now, it's interesting. This is by the guy who directed Shazam, who is a horror director. He did Annabelle Creation.
Oh, right. Lights Out.
And Lights Out.
Okay.
So he's going back to horror.
Yeah. Interesting. Annabelle Creation and Lights Out are both movies that I like.
That's how I feel about Shazam.
You didn't like Annabelle Creation.
Oh, was that the second one?
Yeah, that was the second one where it was like in the old timey.
It was not
Annabelle Comes Home, which I.
Annabelle Comes
like.
Home is the one I liked. Annabelle Creation was monstrous shittiness.
But Lights Out was fun.
Anyway, he's doing the Unsound.
The Unsound.
For Netflix, which is cool because Netflix's horror stuff has been pretty good so far.
And you said that was Cullen Bunn?
Yeah, it's Cullen Bunn.
One of his 80,000 titles that he
Correct.
Was written.
Yep.
Can you remind me what it's about?
No.
Okay.
I only read the first season.
I remember there was like
hospital.
It's a psychiatric hospital. I don't know what happened.
Someone's first day working there,
yep.
And things went nutty.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah. I'm sure there's cults and weird.
You know, Cullen Bunn is good at this kind of stuff.
He is. He's very good.
For whatever reason, that one didn't grab me, but because I know he usually has pretty interesting ideas percolating, I could see how it could translate.
He throws like 50 darts at a wall, and more often than not, they stick.
Yeah. that's true. I don't know if he's the most compelling writer. Like, I find it fairly easy to walk away from his properties. but
that's actually reasonable.
But there's, like, I think when he's teamed with a good artist that kind of adds a visual component to his interesting ideas, interesting but maybe not super compelling characters, then the blend can be really good. You know, you get something like, what's the horror one he did with the, that's the painty art?
Manor Black?
Hollows.
Harrow County.
Yeah, that was it. Anyway,
yeah.
What else we got?
The Disney Plus has premiered, so we've got some new announcements on showrunners. Jeremy Slater, who ran The Umbrella Academy for Netflix, is going to run Moon Knight.
This is for Disney Plus?
Yep.
And do we yet know anything about Moon Knight?
No, we just know showrunner.
I think I saw some leaks from those psycho fake news.
Those aren't leaks. That's just making up stuff.
Yeah, you're right. When I say leaks, what I mean to say is like leaks in quotes, like trashy gossip, but there's nothing like official that's come out.
No, all you know is a showrunner. Jessica Bao, who wrote on Silicon Valley and Rick and Morty, and she also wrote the famous Pickle Rick episode, is going to showrun the She-Hulk, which implies a comedic take.
Okay.
And then in that article, Michael Waldron was listed as running Loki. He's another Rick and Morty writer. So apparently they like Rick and Morty over Disney Plus.
Well, I'm hoping that Jessica Bao?
Yeah.
Takes a sort of Dan Slott approach to She-Hulk.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I think that's a good the good building blocks to use.
Is that going
to
be... Are these all in canon?
Yes.
Sort of?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Here's the thing that's interesting.
She-Hulk used to break the fourth wall.
Yeah, and that'd be fun.
I don't know if I quite want that in a, like, canonical sense. I guess when Marvel had been around for a few decades and stuff, it somehow felt like, and her comic was a little sort of off to the side. Because they did the weird thing where, like, in her own comic, she broke the fourth wall, but when she was in the Avengers or the Fantastic Four or something, she didn't.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked that.
Yeah, I like it too.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Like, certainly it's in her history.
Yeah.
I like that they've got talented TV people running this. That gives me... The people who have done this, the stuff they've done is good.
Yeah.
You know...
And that gives me a good hope.
Even though she did do it before Deadpool, if she does it now, people will be like, that's a Deadpool ripoff.
They will, yeah.
So, but that is that said, there's different ways you can break the fourth wall, and they might kind of come up with some new hook to it or something like that.
I have a possibility. What if Deadpool guests on She-Hulk?
No.
And they break the fourth wall together?
No. No. No.
You know,
Nick, why would you make us cry?
You know he's coming.
No.
Deadpool's coming somewhere. He will pop up.
No. We also watched a bunch of trailers.
Yes.
Only two animated ones, but
two from Blumhouse.
The trailer for Soul is the new Pixar movie that's coming out. I guess they're doing two movies next year.
Yeah, they got Adventure.
The Adventure one, it's called.
Adventure.
This
land,
is like a that Soul one was like a teaser trailer.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
Just a kind of a tonal thing.
And it's it seems to be a sort of a jazz musician who maybe dies and finds the afterlife.
I couldn't quite tell what
was... It seems to be about your soul.
It's soul in two ways. It's about soul,
right.
Soul music and soul food and soul, your soul.
Yep. Looks potentially interesting. The visual style looked good.
The animation was fantastic.
I'm a on-again, off-again Pixar person, so yep. We'll see.
I think Pixar hasn't done anything I don't really like. I haven't seen Cars 2 or 3.
Nah.
But even the stuff that's like Monsters University and Finding Dory, I think are fine. But even those I like, they're just not my favorite.
Right.
But everything else they've done, I've been a pretty big fan of.
Yeah.
So I'm excited for this. Then there's a trailer for Scooby.
Yeah.
The CGI re-envisioning of the Scooby-Doo.
It's Scooby-Doo year one because it's like how like Shaggy and Scooby and the gang got together.
But it's a mix because they also have the older characters. And it looks like Scooby and
I thought they
Shaggy
were. Game. I thought even when they were older, they were like I don't know, like in their early teens or something.
I don't know. Scooby and Shaggy look like they were just on the regular model when they get kidnapped by aliens.
Oh, maybe so. It's just got flashback stuff.
I think it's gonna be both. Yeah.
So I know before getting back to the trailer, I know that there's like the new Scooby-Doo cartoon that's. I don't even know if it's still running, but in the last 10 years, there's been some new Scooby-Doo stuff that people seem to like pretty well.
Yeah, Paul Dini show ran one.
Okay, and so here's my question. On that show, and were the threats real, or was it Man in Mask?
Supernatural was real. That was the big twist. That was the big flip of that particular run.
Okay. I remember when I was in the kid... No, this is not when I was a kid. There was something probably when I was in high school called A Pup Named Scooby-Doo, which was them as kids, but it also had the monsters were real in it.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked that one.
Vile Scrappy.
It was right around the era. What's that?
Had Vile Scrappy.
No, not in a pup named Scooby-Doo.
Oh, didn't I thought he showed up on?
Nope.
Because he was a pup.
Yeah, Scooby-Doo Scrappy. Himself was a pup.
Scrappy wasn't even
right.
Born
he would
yet.
Be a zygote.
He's the best version of Scrappy, the unborn version of Scrappy.
Yes. No, Pup Named Scooby-Doo was pretty fun and witty. In that same right before, like kind of like things started to get weird and Ren and Stimpy showed up. What's his name? Ralph Bakshi did his like Mighty Mouse cartoon in like 1990 or 89 or something like that. And I feel like this kind of was slightly of a tone with that where. It was a little. The humor was a little more adult at times, even though it was still a kid-friendly look to it.
Yeah.
And at that time, I kind of liked that they did the real monsters, and I liked it better than regular Scooby-Doo, which I actually don't think was ever that good.
Nope.
Just sort of iconic in its way. So, but it does seem to me that regular Scooby-Doo represents skepticism and overthrowing skeevy capitalists and all that. And I kind of don't want it to just be aliens and monsters.
Apparently it's going to be aliens and monsters.
I don't know.
Also,
could maybe some skeevy, land developer still be in there?
It's possible.
But can make deals with aliens and monsters. It's fine.
One of the things, I'm going to look up the voice cast, but the voices were not good. Like,
I'll agree with that. I technically didn't watch the trailer. I was listening to the trailer as you were watching it.
But like Scooby-Doo is a pretty easy voice to get, and it doesn't sound like him at all.
Yeah, they change those up often enough. I guess I don't have a strong opinion on the voice actors.
Oof. Okay, the voice cast is people you'd know.
Who do we got?
Mark Wahlberg is voicing Blue Falcon, so apparently that's a thing.
Okay, I heard them mention something about...
Yeah, I thought he was just going to be a Halloween costume.
Weird. That is a weird Hanna-Barbera property to pull out.
This is odd. Zac Efron is Fred, Amanda Seyfried is Daphne, Jason Isaacs is voicing Dick Dastardly.
Oh, they're throwing in other Hanna-Barbera characters then.
Gina Rodriguez is voicing Velma, which I guess means they're going to make Velma more Hispanic, although her name is Velma Dinkley, so I guess not.
I saw the CG I saw of them, they all look like their classic versions.
Forte is voicing Shaggy. Okay. I love Will Forte, but I did not think he was doing a good job as Shaggy. No. And then Frank Welker is voicing Scooby-Doo. That's the original Scooby.
Was he?
Yeah.
Well, Frank Welker is not a young voice actor, right?
Yeah, it's just, it's weird to lose
his voice has probably changed.
I didn't know that Frank Welker was the original Scooby voice.
Yeah, I don't know if it was the original, like in the 60s?
He worked with Casey Kasem. Casey Kasem was the other character. Yeah, he's the original Scooby voice.
Are you reading words that actually say that?
I'm going back through his IMDb, and he voiced a Scooby way back when. Let me go all the way back. Let me see how far back he goes, but... I guess it's possible he just picked up in the 2000s. But isn't Welker one of these guys who's been around forever?
Yeah, he did a lot of voices in Transformers.
At least since the 80s, but Scooby-Doo haven't been around since the 60s. Means I believe that it was some rando.
Welker's pretty old. He could have been around the 60s.
This is some scintillating podcast.
All right. Starting in 1969, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? He voiced Fred.
Oh, that's weird.
So not.
So he voiced Fred, not Scooby, and I guess, did he kill the guy who voiced Scooby so he could take his job?
That's what I'm surmising.
As his voice became craggier and more animalistic, he was like, now I must play Scooby.
Yeah, so that's obviously what happened.
Well, he was Megatron. It's only assumes that he would... Yeah.
I'm looking to see when he became Scooby, because it seems clear to me he was voicing Fred... and Dino Mutt. Oh, Dino Mutt probably give a taste of it. Then he did Dinky Dog. Yeah, this all makes sense. I am profiling Frank Welker in
secretly has always wanted to voice Scooby Doo.
It is very clear to me that he had been. What's that movie? The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yep.
He talented Mr. Ripley, the guy who was doing the Scooby. Yeah, he Matt Damon.
I think what it means is that since the 1960s, they've been keeping him away from the property, the producers of Scooby-Doo, knowing full well he was not right for it.
He would come into the office doing the voice like Sean Young dressing him as Catwoman.
Yes, and they were like,
Scooby?
And like, that's great, Frank. Anyway, we got some lines for another show to read, though.
Yeah.
But by 2019, he finally wore them down or killed enough people.
He came in covered in blood, and he's like, now can I be Scooby?
Okay.
Anyway, Frank Welker's a multiple murderer.
Wow.
So now you know. Speaking of murder...
nice segue.
There's a Blumhouse is doing a take on Fantasy Island.
I don't know if people even know what that is anymore.
So it's a show that was on in the 70s and then again in the 90s.
I think that's right.
Yeah, I think so.
About sort of this
island that people would travel to, yeah, in which their problems would sort of resolve through dreamlike vignettes.
Wouldn't they go and live out their fantasies?
Yes, I think. But I think sometimes it was like, I don't know, weirdly I'm mixing it up with its other kind of weird thing of the era, the Love Boat, where like people, I guess couples who had problems would usually find them resolved, or probably if like somebody, a couple was destined to split, they'd both meet somebody or whatever on Love Boat. You know, Fantasy Island I watched as a kid, but I don't remember it well.
I watched the Malcolm McDowell led, because there's a dapper gentleman named Mr. Rourke who runs the thing.
Right.
And then he has his assistant, so it was Tattoo, played by Herbie Villachez in the 70s, and then...
Yep.
Yeah, so I forget who his assistant was on the Malcolm McDowell version, of somebody. But basically, they are these benevolent people with sort of godlike powers who seem to create fantasies for people.
Yep.
And Blumhouse...
Yeah, Mr. Rourke almost like wandered around. It was like Rod Serling walking yeah. around through Twilight Zone episodes, slightly interacting with the people and sending them on their paths, and I'm sure saying kind of cryptic things.
Yep.
Like, you don't know what to, you know, is truly in your heart until you see it.
But also, it was not like a scary horror
No,
thing.
No, it was... Ricardo Montalban played him with a certain degree of warmth.
Yeah, yeah. It was more melodrama and uplifting.
Blumhouse is changing that.
Yeah, Blumhouse is doing a horror take on this where basically... It makes so much sense to me as a pitch. Basically, you come to this thing, they're like, oh, this is an island where your dreams come true. And of course, there's a dark monkey's paw twist to it.
Yeah,
yeah, that's exactly right. Somebody's likened it a little bit to Saw, and I see what they mean in the sense that at least the first Saw, the one I do like, was meant to throw people into moral quandaries.
Yeah.
And I see that there's people, like, there's a girl in this who, a woman, who mentioned something about, like, her fantasy being getting some sort of revenge on someone who, another girl who tormented her, like, in high school or something like
yeah.
that. And it looks like she's sees this woman behind like a glass, like what would you call those things? I don't know, a glass, a two-way, one-way glass, whatever. It looks like somebody's about to murder or torture her
yeah.
old enemy, and all this weird stuff.
And then she discovers that person is real. It's not like a hologram.
Right. At first, they think it's kind of fake, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's somebody who I'm gonna guess lost a kid, and they
yeah.
like maybe see their kid brought back to life.
Yeah.
So it didn't. That said, this did not look super serious. Like it looks like it's gonna be a kind of a fun, scary movie, but
yeah.
not a deep, deep movie.
Right.
But as I've found with kind of even the lighter weight Blumhouse stuff, there's usually kind of some interesting dynamics to be explored and, you know, some morality plays to happen.
And it looks like the person playing the Ricardo Montalban is Michael Peña.
Yes.
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah, I think he's having fun. It looked like a fun,
yeah,
fun outing.
Yeah, it's got my attention.
Yeah.
Then there was The Invisible Man, another take on Invisible Man, which looks... more in line with that, was it Kevin Bacon's...
Hollow Man.
Hollow Man,
yeah,
where he was like a sociopath.
Right, and that was by, what's-his-face, Starship Troopers, Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, not one of his better movies, but... and I don't think I've ever seen it all the way through, but once or twice I've seen a few scenes, and I was like, okay, there's some individual interesting bits and pieces in here, but not great.
Well, it's interesting, because Alan Moore took the original Invisible Man
yeah.
and made him kind of a sociopath.
Yep.
Right.
And
now, I think...
Is that from the original story?
Yeah.
Was he that kind of dangerous guy?
You know, here's the thing. I don't know that I've read the original story. I've watched the original movie, though, and liked it quite a bit. And he was absolutely a, like, megalomaniac.
Okay.
Kind of a fun-to-watch one, and another one of those, like, vintage horror characters that I am sure informed people like Dr. Doom and Dr. Octopus and all those kind of ranting
okay.
madmen of all Marvel right. and stuff. So
this is an interesting revamp then, because they're basically taking it through like a domestic violence lens,
right? Her husband dies.
Her husband died. He's super rich and at least emotionally abusive and possibly physically abusive.
And I guess he leaves her $5 million, but she has to be declared sane by
right.
It's Elizabeth Moss, by the way.
Yeah.
And she's great.
And what is clear is that the revenge he wants to take on her is to torment her without ever revealing himself so that she cannot claim the money because he's going to make her like her life a nightmare.
Yeah.
And it seems like the ultimate version of gaslighting in a way.
Yeah.
There's a few scenes that I thought were a bit conventional, but there were also a creepy scene where, like, clearly she is telling people, like, that this person, there's a, you know...
Like, in the room.
Yeah,
with
she's like, there's someone sitting in that chair right there. And they're like, are you serious? But it's creepily played, yeah. And several times when she knows he's in the room, even when she's trying to tell somebody about it and stuff like that, there's a... I didn't quite like how they played it because I thought they overplayed it, but there's a scene where she steps out onto like her patio at night and she's breathing frost and you see a breath of frost next to hers.
I like this trailer. I'm intrigued by it.
It's a pretty good trailer. It's written by the guy and maybe directed by the guy who has written all the Insidious movies, who wrote the first Saw,
okay,
and some other stuff, if I'm not mistaken. And he's got a pretty good track record. He may have written, like, one or two of the lame Annabelles, too. Like, he's kind of prolific, and I don't think everything he touches turns to gold.
Yeah.
But he's got a solid track record. And he does always bring more to it, I would say, than just a... It's not going to be just a bunch of jump scares. There will be a story to be told, as I think they suggest here. It looks very triggering, what I would imagine, for a lot of people. Yeah. So, you know, heads up.
Yeah. And finally, Color Out of Space, the H.P. Lovecraft story starring Nicolas Cage from the producers of Mandy. And is it the director of Mandy, or is it just the producers?
I guess I hadn't noticed that it was even the producers of Mandy.
Yeah, I remember hearing something about Mandy.
Okay, only because Nicolas Cage in it was did I kind of get some of those vibes.
It is definitely, let's see. Richard Stanley is the writer-director.
That's the guy who, like, the director who had disappeared after the disastrous Island of Dr. Moreau in the 90s.
Really?
Yeah. Why when Tommy Chong, is it? Shows up in this, like, kind of looking like a crazy madman, it reminded me of Crazy Madman, who was the Dr. Moreau?
Marlon Brando.
Marlon Brando in, like, his white face paint or whatever.
Yep. That's right, I've forgotten that this was the Island of Dr. Moreau guy.
Yeah, he is either going to come back and, like, people are going to be like, oh my gosh, this guy who could have been brilliant and lost, you know, his career got detoured unfairly is in fact great, or it's going to be possibly garbage.
It's going to cement his place in the...
The Laura is a destroyer of properties.
Yep.
It's an interesting trailer. Like I have not read this story in so long that I don't quite remember how it plays out. But there is a crashed meteor, and I don't know if I'm mixing it up with another story. But in my memory, it was like both had its own strange kind of like ultraviolet color that like people couldn't describe the color that it was. But I also thought it like leached the color out of everything else and like kind of left everything gray and ashen around it. Huh. But that's the kind of thing that probably happens in a lot of Lovecraft stories.
Yeah.
And I cannot quite remember. I'm gonna try and give it a reread. But clearly basically this meteor crashes nearby and begins causing like what looks like strange psychotropic horrific visions for people. People maybe start acting sadistically or, you know, murderously.
Goes Nicolas Cage a couple of times.
Once or twice in there. He's mostly pretty sedate in it. Which
maybe
he was
not full
in
Cage.
He was in Mandy
like
until the end. And then he went like ash in like Army of Darkness is the only way I can describe it in Mandy. People haven't seen Mandy. It is a fun ride, but it's like a slow movie until it's not. So just a heads up. But this actually looked at least interesting enough that I would want to hear reviews and kind of see what the buzz is.
I'll have to hear reviews on this one. I don't know.
That director, and Island of Dr. Moreau was a movie I saw in the theater.
I did too.
And I still feel a little scarred by it, to be honest.
To be fair, he was on it for a week.
Is that the deal?
Yeah, and then he was fired and replaced by John Frankenheimer.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's one of those movies where, like, all the pieces seem good. It's like a classic horror story. John Frankenheimer's in it. Marlon Brando's in it.
Val Kilmer. I think what killed it.
Wasn't
it the egos of Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando clashing that killed
it? Probably.
That's the story I'd always heard.
Maybe
but
so.
But it's not a good movie.
At any rate, this guy, you can't take your hatred of that movie out on him. He was only on it for a week before they fired
him. Yeah, but
he's set the tone.
Movie since then.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe
he was scarred.
The movie scarred everybody who touched it. But yeah, I like the premise behind Color Out of Space. At least what we see of in the trailer here. So maybe.
All right, that is it for our news for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics.
One familiar cry. Rogue Cast.
We're talking comics week of Wednesday, November 13th, and...
Pretty good week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it November 13th already?
I think so. That means Thanksgiving is tomorrow. No.
Yes.
All right, it's soon. It's soon,
well,
though.
BGGCon is coming up for me, and then Thanksgiving, and then it's going to be Christmas, and man, everything's going to... roll right through there, and the year will be over.
Yep.
And we roll into 2020.
Let's go ahead and just continue this podcast into our best year of the end of the year best of list.
Yes.
I can't say words.
I was trying to schedule the end of the year last night.
Yeah.
I was messaging like, hey, we should start. Neither of you guys came through with a lot of enthusiasm about let's do best of the year. I feel like you always feel like it's a death march.
A little bit, because you're making crazy lists all year long, and we have to go and make crazy lists now. Because
we do not make lists.
Right, I don't make lists, but I will say my favorite single issue of the year is that Black Cat issue with Batroc.
That was last week.
All right, that's all I got. I'm done. I'm done.
This is why you got to make lists throughout the year, because your memory will fail you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what? When someone gets tapped to replace Santa... It's not going to be... It's going to be me, because I make lists.
Well, you definitely got the jolliness down.
yeah, I've got the name. Sir. I don't know what the hell you guys are talking about.
That's right.
All right.
Old Saint Bud.
Yep.
Nick, why don't you start us off here?
All right. Well, I'm going to talk about an X-Men book, because why not?
But it's not X-Men, which came out this week.
That's right. This is the final of the new series. This is Fallen Angels number 1.
Oh, isn't it?
This is the last book of the new series that have been launched.
Right. So with this coming out, we now have a pretty good sense of the scope and style.
I mean, next year there's going to add more, but you know.
Right. But we know what mutant books are going to be like for a while.
Correct.
Now.
And this one is written by Brian Hill, art by somebody Kurdansky.
Who's Brian Hill?
Brian Hill has been doing. It's Simon Kurdansky is the artist, but Brian Hill is the guy who's what? Batman the Outsider.
Yes. Okay. He did a few different
and a few other books.
Okay.
None have really stood out to me.
Right.
Yeah.
He's new-ish.
But
new to us.
This one, which is a book that focuses on the character of Psylocke, specifically, not to delve too far into the world of Psylocke, but there are now two people.
Yeah.
They are separated finally, and so there is Quanon, which was the Asian badass Psylocke, and then there's Betsy Braddock, who has now become Captain Britain.
Right.
This all focuses on Quanon and sort of deals with her upbringing, her sort of mental issues that she's had by being stuck in a body that she hasn't been in control of.
Oh, that's weird. Does it mean she could like see but not alter things?
A little bit.
That's horrible.
That's horrifying, and she's sort of coming to terms with that, while like being on an island where she can actually talk to Betsy and kind of deal with that, and she can't quite decide if she wants to talk to her, ignore her, live her
kill
life.
Her.
She is sort of the more bloodthirsty. She's the trained assassin that was. I remember Quanon as being Matsuo, the hand guy.
Yeah, you're right.
And he was like her right hand, like as Lady Mandarin.
This thing always, 20, 30 years, whatever, it still confuses me, the whole Quanon Psylocke thing. And I feel like it was a kludgy way to try to get the character I like back.
If I had to guess, they probably don't. You don't need to like know any about this, right?
Other than that, she had this weird joining with somebody else.
They give you a recap.
They give you everything you need to know.
I was under the impression this was like kind of a team book of sorts.
There is, but she's given sort of a vision about a new apocalyptic kind of entity that is kind of ravaging the world with new sort of technology that is kind of drug-like.
Uh-huh.
And
like a glimpse of the future, though? This is, or yeah, is this something that's happening in the present?
The present, and leading to the past. So she is sort of on the trail of that, and she forms a team sort of people who don't quite find peace in the world of Krakoa.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are X-23 and Kid Cable. Even though I know he's called Cable, but he's a kid, so he's Kid Cable. But and that is sort of the team that she's built so far. Sinister is involved.
So this is the
X-Magneto's mentioned.
This is the mutant murderer book.
It's kind of the mutant murderer book, which is a little weird because one of their big no-nos is don't kill any humans.
That is one of Krakoa's big no-nos.
Exactly.
Doesn't necessarily really have to be theirs.
Yes.
Yeah. Why, by the way, shouldn't that be like, don't kill any sentience? Because that makes it sound like killing mutants might be okay. Like,
right.
That can't be.
But yeah, because mutants come back.
But mutants can come back. Humans can't.
By the way, we're talking about sort of the darker edge of this. The art looks very kind of shadowy and like, almost, I don't want to say noir, but kind of noir.
It reminds me of what I've always wanted like Clayton Crane's work to look like. It's like a little less stylized, but sort of dark.
Right.
Shadowy. I think it's really good, and it fits the tone that Brian Hill's going for in this one. I was kind of, this was the one I was most on the fence with. I was like, am I really going to enjoy this?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that was, I really did. It was dark and a little depressing.
Yep.
Because it definitely deals with some stuff I didn't know about Quanon and what drives her and some sadness in her life.
Yeah.
But it's compelling character bits that I think really are an emotional drive for the story.
Yeah.
So I'm down with that. I also really do like X-23 or Laura and Cable. I've always liked this new iteration of him is weird, but
why is he a kid?
Because this is a future self that came back and killed his older self.
Yep.
It's Cable. It's time travel. It doesn't
so
make
it is,
much
it
sense.
It is Cable, but it's just a younger incarnation of him?
Yeah, it's
like,
basically...
Or some not as far from the future.
It's a younger incarnation that basically came back to sort of send the young X-Men back to the past.
Oh,
and
in that
storyline? Like, yeah, sort of right the world. But
we've all been there. We've all been there, traveling back in time to kill our older selves.
I'm just doing it today.
Oh, yeah, see, exactly.
But yeah, I also really, really like that there is sort of a chronology to the X-Books. You know, if you do read all of them, you can sort of see the world kind of being built up, and they're all interconnected.
The strange world of Krakoa.
And they're all sort of referencing each other, so I do appreciate that.
Nice.
It
does seem like Hickman is a man with a plan.
Yeah, and it seems like he's working well with people, which... I honestly wouldn't have thought that.
Yeah, I kind of like Grant Morrison thought he was like a guy who did his own thing and then disappeared into the mists.
But Grant Morrison worked well with people. Look at 52. He was involved in that.
That's true, but I've never seen him oversee multiple projects. That
true.
Was like one where he was part of a team.
Yeah,
But
that's
yeah,
true.
This is a little different.
This is a little different.
And I'm not, to be honest, like, although I for sure am more of a Morrison guy than a Hickman guy, I don't think Morrison could actually kind of do what he's doing. I don't think it's kind of hidden in his wheelhouse.
No. But yeah, Fallen Angels. It was very good. Dave, what did you pick?
I picked the second of Joe Hill's curated horror line for DC, for their Hill House comics, called The Dollhouse Family. So this is issue one of Dollhouse Family.
And if I was not in X-Men mode, perpetual X-Men mode, this would have been one of my picks. I really liked it.
I think we all like this book.
It really bodes well for the line that there's been two issues and they've both been really grabbers.
Yeah, we could have group picked this one.
We could have. We didn't.
Oh, that's true. This is written by Mike Carey and drawn by Peter Gross. They are a team that has worked together since forever,
but
at least as far back as the Lucifer spinoff of Sandman.
Yep.
And then after that, they did for Vertigo Unwritten, right? And this looks like another winner from them. These guys just work great together.
It's sort of one of those Brubaker, Sean Phillips. They've been working with each other. They know their kind of tone.
Yeah, and I'm sure they like know how to like bolster each other's strengths and probably like pave over their weaknesses. If I had to guess. And this is kind of like like the other one, what was the other Joe Hill book?
Basketful of Heads.
Just like Basketful of Heads, this is a character-oriented, kind of dark... It's not... I mean... Yes, it's horror, or it's like clearly going there.
It's going in that direction, yeah.
But it kind of feels like a gothic story.
Yeah.
And it's not definitely like all on the front, or all right there in the first issue. This is all just great character building that has a dark supernatural turns. Yeah. And it starts with a, what is it? Is it an aunt? A great aunt has died, and this is 1979 in England. And among the things she has bequeathed is this old Victorian dollhouse to the daughter of a... they seem like they might be a newlywed, newlywed-ish couple, British couple.
I mean, not that newlywed. Their daughter's like 8.
That's true. They could have had her out of wedlock, Randy.
It's possible.
All right. So she's super excited for it. And without saying too much... This dollhouse, she's like playing with it, and her parents are watching her or listening, and it's like she immediately has names for all of the people that are kind of strange names, mm-hmm. but it's like as if she knows the history of the dolls that are inside it, and like is really connected with it instantly. And also there's...
And the dollhouse is like super detailed.
Right, it is weirdly detailed, and without saying too much... Before the thing is over, she will, in essence, find a way to go inside the dollhouse, and strange things will occur there.
Yep.
This is set against a backdrop of kind of somewhat difficult to read domestic abuse. He is an abuser, and the husband, and he's a scumbag, but like it covers a span of time that I think. I want to say, like, is it 10 years? Because at some point it's in 19... Oh, no, it was just 1980. That's right, because it was 79 to 80. I know there is some flash forward. It's not as much as I thought. Anyway, but their story is compelling and interesting throughout. And the human...
It goes to 82.
Okay, 82. And it's an interesting human drama. It's intercut with a story set in 1826 of a guy who's doing, like, land surveying... And finds this mysterious cave, and I'm not going to say what's in there, but there's some unusual stuff that obviously will ultimately tie into this. But it's creepy and weird, and yet it's weird. It's weird in a way where I feel like I kind of know at least all the basics of what's going on. It's not confusing per se. It's just mysterious.
It reminds me of Basketful of Heads.
Yeah,
it's good character stuff. It's a really interesting premise. I don't actually know where the book's going to go, but it's intriguing enough to get me. This is what a good first issue should do.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to tell me everything, but it needs to tell me enough where I'm like, there's enough here where I want to see where you're going.
Yep. And it has like a notable ending.
Yeah.
That to make you want to read more.
Well, it also makes you care about the characters.
We equated, you know, Joe Hill certainly has something in common with his dad, and that is that he knows that if not, even though they have different styles, that a horror story is meaningless, I think, if you don't have some investment in what the story is. And also, like, it's in the characters. So you have to have strong characters, and I think both... by the way, Joe Hill is he credited with writing on this?
No. This is just straight up
my character. I think he's just an idea man, basically.
Okay. There's also... there's an imagination that to the horror in it. You know, this is not stock horror, just like Basketful of Heads was not. Like, I can't think, that old cliche where an abused girl finds her way into a mysterious supernatural dollhouse.
Yep.
That is not a cliche.
Nope.
The closest I could think of to what it reminded me of a little bit was Coraline. The strange other world that Coraline goes to. And this is definitely going to be, I think, a darker story than that, which was like... kind of like a YA story from Neil Gaiman.
Joe Hill describes this book in the sort of backup as Indian in the Cupboard, if the Enchanted Cupboard was secretly a door to hell.
Yeah, that sounds right. Anyway, yeah, so we all liked the Dollhouse family, and it's got a cool cover. You can look for the girl hiding behind the creepy dollhouse. Yep. Randy, what do you have?
All right, so I had a bunch of possibilities this week, but I settled on one that we've already talked about numerous times.
Yep.
Because it was just so good. And that is Black Cat Annual number 1.
A good annual?
Yeah.
What?
Oh my God, it is. Weird.
How is that even possible?
So, Black Cat has a heist she needs to pull. There's a weird... There's a weird, the Magia, which was the Mafia, but in the 70s when Marvel was doing the comics, they were afraid to actually call it the Mafia because the Mafia was powerful. So they made it the Magia.
Yeah, like, it's just spelled like, well, it's spelled similarly to Mafia, but with a G.
But Jen McKay, who's the writer on this, he has, Felicia narrates all of this. Yeah. The narration is half the reason to read it. But she's talking about it. She's at a church, and this is called Part 1, The Wedding of the Martyrs. And she says, but Felicia, you say, they're just your run-of-the-mill gangsters with esoteric traditions and a fixation on death rays and robots. How is that weird? So they've definitely...
He kind of ran with how Marvel used them in, like, the 70s and 80s, where...
they had big robots.
Right, they were like the Mafia, but the Mafia, if they had kind of used the sort of super science and weird stuff of the Marvel Universe.
So this all starts with this interesting notion of the Wedding of the Martyrs, where two families are feuding, so a prince or princess from each family, basically, come together, get married, and then fight to the death to solve the... And so... And when they do this, they go to the place where there's a Magia vault. And so Black Cat decides to rob it. She needs a play husband for this, and so she picks up her old boyfriend, Spider-Man.
Yep.
And it's Black Cat and Spider-Man running a heist on the Magia. And it's as much fun as you'd imagine. There's also some spotlights on her crew, the big guy and her tech guy, as they jump around. And it's got traps. It's got great, like, romantic banter. It has,
They're kind of interesting exes at this point, Spider-Man and Black Cat.
I just want to read one page that made me fall in love with this. Again, this is Black Cat narrating her own story as they're, like, they're diving into this tomb. She says, I'm tomb raiding a secret mob crypt under Long Island with my superhero ex-boyfriend. They sort of married, and I look totally great. You think Captain Marvel gets up to stuff this cool? No way. She hangs out in space with Canadians. What a nerd. Crime rules. And the book is full of that kind of stuff. It's so much fun. Reminds me of what I loved about the short-lived Domino book. This is just a great fun read, and has nice art by Joey Vasquez and Juan Gideon and Natasha Bustos. Definitely worth a read, and really good stuff. Also on the list this week, the other possible jumping up for me would be Family Tree, which is a very strange new image book from Jeff Lemire and artist Phil Hester about a apocalypse that takes place that seems to be, the inciting incident seems to be people turning into trees.
Yes, and it seems to be, from what I read when I was reading the solicit and is set up here, he loves his families with problems, Jeff Lemire, and a family with problems... finds that the daughter / sister in this family, whoever she is to the various people, has begun to like grow this like bark like skin, and like even there's like leaves and stuff forming on it, and it looks like they're going to the format of the book is, I think, going to be sort of a road trip with this what do you call a family that's kind of a broken up family or a
I don't know,
there's a word, it's with a D, it's a
dysfunctional,
thank you. Dysfunctional family on the road, but it's got strong characters like Lemire tends to do, and interesting like plot beats. So yeah, I think did we all like this one?
Yeah,
that's another all one that everybody wants.
Well, the Phil Hester artwork doesn't hurt.
Oh, Phil Hester, Phil Hester's great.
He's great.
And then Punisher Soviet, which is Garth Ennis returning to the character, along with artist Jason Burroughs, who I think does some of his strongest work.
Yep, I thought it was good too.
Has another vigilante operating along, basically seems to be operating like Frank does.
Yep. Right, like where Frank is like, I kind of admire what's going on here.
The opening scene where he's basically, Frank is walking through a murder scene. Yeah, he's somebody like using an AK-47 with such precision that even he has to give them props.
Right. Like, he kind of does this interesting thing where he sort of CSIs it while he's walking through it. And it was kind of a cool scene.
It's more this book gets more into the head of the Punisher than I've seen in quite some time.
Yeah, Ennis did a good job of that.
Yeah, he always has.
I thought it was really good. 7 Days number 2, which is the next part of Gail Simone's big superhero epic, which I've been enjoying. Usagi Yojimbo number 6, which is a remastered version of the very first Usagi story. Basically, it fleshes it out beyond the original 8 pages. Takes his new art style to it. It's a 35th anniversary, so that was a lot of fun.
Okay.
History of the Marvel Universe number 5, which gets into all the stuff Bendis did.
Whoa!
And then there's a book called Dungeons and Drawings, which is a... basically, it's like a D&D-style book.
Like an encyclopedia of monsters.
On one page, you'll have this piece of art by... Blanca Martinez de Ricciardo and Joe Sparrow. And then on the left side, there's a ranking of their combat, magic, smarts, loot, and danger, and a little write-up. It's super fun and super cute, and I think one of those things that would be an amazing like Christmas gift for any kid who likes Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, the art has sort of has a stylized look to it that's not like the photorealism in a lot of D&D type products, but kind of a cool stylish, I don't know, like it almost looks like what Pixar's conceptual artists might be doing. Really, really beautiful look to it.
And by kid, I mean anybody in their 40s, because I kind of want this book.
And the write-ups on the creatures look like I haven't read those yet to see how they describe them and if they're like tongue in cheek or not, but they're not super dense. It's like two or three paragraphs.
Right. And then finally, I didn't get a chance to read this yet, but I'm going to. It's an original graphic novel called Firefly the Sting. It is written by Delilah S. Dawson with a few different people on art.
Is this Firefly as in Whedon's Firefly?
Yes. It is Saffron returns to the Serenity with no Mal, recruits a team of women to join her on a heist.
Okay.
I like that's heists, all-female heist starring Saffron and World of Firefly. I'm in for that. I'm going to check that out.
Sounds all right.
Dave, what else you got?
Let's see. Second issue of The Batman's Grave, a.k.a. Warren Ellis's 12-issue Batman miniseries. This is an interesting and unusual series, and I cannot quite tell where he's headed with it, but I'm enjoying it quite a bit. This one actually has a very extended action sequence with... I guess I'd forgotten how good Warren Ellis' action choreography can be. I still wish he used sound effects, which I know are just too childish for him, probably. Mm-hmm. But he and Hitch are really good together. What did they get together on? Stormwatch way back when?
Yeah.
And then Authority?
Yeah.
This follows up the kind of deep murder mystery that Batman was dealing with last time, but there's a big action sequence, and the people who know Warren Ellis' stuff, like on, was it Moon Knight, where he did a few just full action issues, like one that was a tribute to the Raid and stuff like that?
Yeah. Yep.
There is some big action along those levels. It is a great fight, I gotta say. It's one of the best fight, probably the best fight I've seen in a comic all year. And it does continue the conversation that Alfred and Bruce had in the previous issue that was where Alfred is kind of being critical of his mission and, you know, the short-term nature of it versus things he could do with his money that would be more long-term. I still cannot tell if Warren Ellis is ultimately has anything to say about this since it's really, it's such a fictional construct. Like, you know, we know that Batman tends to, you know, that a book about Bruce Wayne donating, you know, all of his money to charity and just purely using it for altruistic purposes is not an action-adventure book with cool Batman fights. So I don't know if, you know, like, is he trying to paint Bruce into a corner, but he's brought these things up, and it does seem like he's got some somewhat thoughtful writing about that. Like, I don't think he's doing this just to undermine Batman as a concept, but there is some subversion going on, and I can't quite see where he wants to take it. Anyway, it continues to be interesting throughout and a little bit weirder as of this issue even than it was in the first issue. So, but I like it and generally recommend it.
By the way, just as a side note, The Batman's Grave would be an exceptionally good title for a horror anthology starring Batman.
Yeah, I like it. There was a new Morbius comic from Marvel. Is this an ongoing?
I don't know, actually.
Yes.
All right.
But we all know a Morbius series is never going to last.
You don't think we're going to be seeing issue 67?
I do not see issue 75 of Morbius in our future.
Yep.
Nope.
But I was flipping through it and it looked kind of cool to me. And I'm
If you like living vampires, there's living vampires.
Actually, you know what the scene one there is in it that looked fascinating to me? Is he's I guess Morbius is often working trying to cure himself of his like science produced vampirism. And there's a scene, I couldn't quite tell what was happening, where he's, like, looking at his face in a mirror, and he seems overjoyed and ecstatic. He's like, it worked. And I realized, oh, he can see his reflection now.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's kind of neat. I didn't get around to checking it, but I think y'all might have enjoyed this book, Far Sector.
It's an interesting new...
it's a Green Lantern book produced for DC's Young Animal line.
Yeah.
By a award-winning sci-fi author, J.K. or N.K. Jemisin, I think?
Yep. But yeah, it's about a Green Lantern on sort of the farthest reaches of space.
Yeah, and she's a human
mm-hmm.
From Earth.
Yep.
And then she's out on this weird alien planet.
Dealing with sort of local life forms. And in a world where murder doesn't happen, something occurs.
A little more ambitiously sci-fi, would you say, than standard Green Lantern books?
Yes.
Not like just straight up like, the Red Lanterns are at it again.
No, no, there's definitely more of a sci-fi bent to it.
There's a new ElfQuest miniseries from, you know, they've finished all the big sort of epic quest stuff, but this takes one of the main supporting characters, or not main supporting characters, one of the main characters, Skywise, and gives him his own gives him his own series. There's a book called Unsacred, miniseries by Mirka Andolfo. Is that her name? The writer-artist of A Natural, who kind of, you know, she's got that cheesecakey style. This was like her first... her first project, and no doubt got kind of greenlit for a reprint. Because she's a European artist.
Yeah.
I don't know if she's coming out of, like, Italy or Spain.
I don't remember.
But what would you say this is about, Nick? Is it a devil
it's
and an angel?
A devil and angel sort of falling in love.
Okay, yeah.
And sort of their adventures of dating and courting each other.
Yeah, it's a little more cartoony than Unnatural was.
Yeah.
Mirka Andolfo is Italian.
Okay. There's the final issue of Unbeatable Squirrel Girl. It's hard to believe, but it has gone 50 issues. I don't know if I expected that to happen.
Wow.
But it's an issue that, in flipping through it, looks like it's got both some fun stuff and a sort of heartfelt finale. That's kind of sweet and has, as always, some really great artwork. I don't know if this is... Has this been the same artist throughout?
Is it... it's not Erica... No, I don't think
Erica Henderson? I see her name on the cover, but I don't know
I
if...
I think she may have done some, but she left to go do Assassination. So
you're right.
She...
Okay, Derek Charm is the artist on it currently.
Yeah, he was an Archie guy.
Okay. Oh, it looks like she did the outro sequence, so they kind of like let her come in and finish it.
That's cool.
I think that's everything for me.
I should have a couple more. Guardians of the Galaxy number 11, which is sort of the penultimate issue to Donny Cates' crazy Church of the Universal Truth story.
Yep.
Lots of stuff happens. Seems like everyone's in peril. It's been fun the entire time.
Okay. Yeah.
If you like Donny Cates, try his Guardians of the Galaxy run. It's great. A new book from Boom Studios by Matt Kent. And artist Matt Smith, called Folklords.
Folklords?
Yep.
Okay. Like folklore, but with lords.
Exactly. About a sort of fantasy community where the kids are sort of tasked with choosing a quest to go. And our main character...
Like as a rite of passage?
Yeah. Our main character has sort of had visions of basically our world.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so he wants to choose to find these fabled... creatures called the Folklords. And
okay.
This may or may not be something that the rest of the town, which is very kind of usually on their own, wants that to happen. So it's a really fun kind of adventure or young adventure kind of book.
I like the art in it, though, which has kind of a fun cartoony style to it.
And Matt Ken is... he's a writer who's done a ton of work, I think. Or
yeah, he's done a lot of indie stuff. He's pretty prolific.
Is he the guy who did Mind Management?
Yeah, he did Mind Management. He did Department H.
And where Mind Management was like bonkers and kind of high concept, this feels very approachable and fun.
You know, Department H was just a murder mystery like on a deep sea station of sorts. So he can do kind of straightforward, I think.
But the fantasy trappings and sort of...
Does he do Black Badge, or is that somebody else?
Oh, no, that is him.
Medicine,
that is him as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He does weird stuff.
He does weird stuff. He does very very good stuff, though.
Yeah.
So, and the art by Matt Smith, which I know Matt Smith from somewhere, but...
Probably Doctor Who.
Probably Doctor Who. I thought it was a great
I'll
first
take
issue.
A look. That sounds potentially up my alley.
And then my last one was X-Men number 2. Still digging this book. This is sort of flagship, written by Jonathan Hickman, art by Lineal Francis Hugh. This is dealing with some fallout of stuff that happened in X-Force, but also the appearance of another island that apparently Krakoa is on a path to crashing with.
Island fight!
Yep, it is essentially an island fight, and Cyclops and his two kids, Cable and Rachel Summers,
yep,
who is still going by the stupid name of Prestige.
Yeah,
I just really just go by Rachel. It's fine.
Yeah, somebody who liked that movie Prestige named her.
Yeah, they must have, but because I really don't like it. Anyways, they sort of go to the island to sort of see what the hubbub is all about.
Yep. Let's go punch the island.
It's essentially kind of let's go punch the island, and I had to. It had a great sense of fun and adventure to it. It is not Fantasy Island.
Is it Dinosaur Island?
There are semi kind of dinosaurs on it.
So it's Dinosaur Island.
Yeah. But there are kind of wacky, crazy creatures inhabiting. Hmm. There's also the introduction of something that's going to be a big thing for his run. So I'm not going to spoil anything. But it is a very good issue. I think if you're enjoying X-Men at this point, you've got a lot to choose from.
Yeah, apparently.
X-Men is the one I would probably pay most the most attention if you have to be pick and choose.
Right.
But I'm excited because this is X-Men is essentially a summer's book at this point. Both of the issues have focused on Cyclops, and I'm for that.
What would you say is the second most must read of them?
After X-Men? I think if I had to pick out of all of them, I would probably go Marauders.
Interesting. Okay.
Marauders was the most entertaining.
And yet, the only one that has the consensus pick is Excalibur.
It's true.
That's right. If there's no British mutants, then I'm not interested.
all right, that's comics. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some TV and movies.
One familiar cry.
Okay, so there's been some TV.
Yep.
And a launch of a streaming service. And Dave and I both have Alamo Passes, so we've seen 100 movies each.
That's true. I am trying to get the best use I can out of my Alamo Pass.
Yeah, me too. I want to make sure they.
I feel like instead of seeing like the bare minimum of 2 a month, that I'm seeing like 6 or 8 a month.
Yeah, I know. I'm like at 3 or 4, and I'm pretty happy about it.
Yep.
Okay, so let's talk about TV. Nick, you and I think last week were watching, and now we've finished up Jack Ryan season 2.
Yep.
We both liked it.
Yeah.
Although I think we both. Not sure about the ending, maybe?
Yeah, the ending goes into some crazy G.I. Joe levels.
It gets a little, like, Jack Ryan is...
Just like the movies have sometimes done?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of fits. Much. You know, the third act of Jack Ryan, the Jack Ryan movie is always like...
The CIA analyst saying, I'm just an analyst, give me that AK-47.
It's the same thing.
Oh, that's funny.
And I think the best thing about the TV show is their reinvention of Greer. Wendell Pierce plays him, and he plays him as sort of this older CIA agent. He's not a Navy guy.
This is, of course, James Earl Jones' character from the movies.
He was Navy. He was
former Navy.
He's former Navy turned CIA.
But he's not going to become an admiral.
Correct. But this is also a reinvention of Jack Ryan, too, because it's definitely, he is a little more soldiery.
That's true. Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean...
And the big action at the end of the season, it's not like just a bunch of other people, like the Rainbow Six team or something like that.
It's Jack... And a couple Jack of leading a like black ops team that he put in the field. It's actually you know how Clear and Present Danger had that sort of like him going to rescue the black ops team that he put in the field, even though he doesn't know it
against the drug cartel.
Yes,
it's very similar here, except instead of a drug cartel, it's a sovereign nation.
it's a little nuts.
It gets okay. I don't want to spoil. You know what? I'm going to spoil it. If you haven't seen Jack Ryan season 2 and you're worried about this, I'm sorry. Just skip past this, but. It's the president of Venezuela.
Uh-huh.
The actual president of Venezuela.
They
fictionalized him, so it's not Hugo Chavez, but it's definitely supposed to be something like that.
Yeah, it's
like
supposed
that.
To be Hugo.
He is a corrupt guy. He's had, like, these prison camps where he's in prison, and he's about to lose his election. He pays for the murder of a U.S. senator who's, like, Jack's friend in the early episodes. Jack goes to him in, like, episode 3. They're having this, like, diplomatic meeting between... The ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Venezuela, Jack Ryan, and a CIA agent. And Jack goes up to the president of Venezuela, and he's like, I know you killed my friend. And I'm like, I don't think that's good diplomacy. And then, in the tail end, like, I understand the country's in upheaval, the election's happening, the president's trying to shut it down, but Jack takes the remnant of this black ops unit that hasn't been killed in a helicopter against the direct orders of the CIA... And they go land in the presidential palace to go and rescue Greer from the prison compound inside the presidential palace, where the president of Venezuela is holding this one CIA agent. And it's a little ridiculous.
It's a little ridiculous, and yet still compelling.
The action is really good. I love watching them just kind of go through.
Who's the guy who plays the station chief of Venezuela?
This feels like, by the way,
I think it's like Phil Stamper, Doug Stamper, or is that his character name?
That might be his character. He's the guy that was on House of Cards, yeah. Sort of Kevin Spacey's fixer. He's been in several movies where you're just like, he's that guy. And he is awesome in this great. Show.
The cast is so good in this.
You know what this sounds like? This sounds like the video game of this show,
yeah.
Where they need to like action it up a bit.
But there are some good moment-to-moment stuff. Good
Michael
writing.
Kelly is.
And
Michael
is it
Kelly.
More subtle in general?
No.
No, it's okay. Like hitting your head with a cudgel.
It's basically it's
less
a more,
subtle than the movie the three kind of good movies.
In its way, it's more like a reinvention of 24.
Okay.
Yeah. It feels like a 24.
Like a somewhat better 24, yeah. Or slightly yeah. More sophisticated.
A little bit,
But I would say if you like 24, you'll probably like this. And not
I mean, 24 had some wild stuff, like goth... Was it Chloe?
Yeah.
Yes.
And not just because it has the same sort of right-wing leanings that all action movies do.
Right.
But this is also John Krasinski. He's good in the role.
He's really good as Jack Ryan.
He basically moves the whole... I mean, he is the star.
They definitely reference some of the books because and the movies because there is a shootout here that is feels very similar to what happened in Present Danger with the SUVs and the getting blacked in. And
it is
and
not as taut and
no, but that's one, such a great scene.
Yeah,
That's weird. Yeah, I don't know that I don't think I would have gone back to the well on that with unless I was like doing an adaptation of that story.
But Dave, it's in Venezuela instead of in Colombia.
Oh well, that's completely different.
Yes. But anyway, it's. It's good. It carried me all the way through.
Yeah, exactly.
But it definitely was some issues with it.
And I'll look forward to the season 3 because I'm sure that got greenlit.
Yeah, probably so. All right, so moving on, we've got Terminator Dark Fate, which Dave and I both saw.
Yes.
I, through circumstance, wound up seeing it twice.
Right.
Did you see it twice because you liked it so much?
I mean, I wouldn't have gone to see it a second time if I didn't like it. I saw it the first time Dave and I were supposed to go. He had to cancel. I went in and went. And then Dave last minute was like, hey, I'm going to go see it. And I'm like, I'll go see it again.
I'm just assuming Dave like just shackled you to him and dragged you to see Dark.
That is correct, yes.
You know, the interesting thing about this movie is that all my friends who were seeing it, because like I wasn't even sure if I wanted to see it. But I saw enough friends who saw it and said, hey, this is really good. Probably the best since the first two. And maybe since Sarah Connor. Because I know a lot of people who liked Sarah Connor Chronicles, including myself. But then it's like tanking at the box office.
I was gonna say, yeah.
And so there was kind of
it's on track to
better watch it quick.
Better go soon. Yeah.
It's on track to lose like $120 million.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and here's the thing: I really like this movie. I also fully understand why people wouldn't go see it because they've effed up three sequels before this.
Yeah, but it is not a super strong franchise overall. We just all love those first two movies so much we keep giving them the benefit of the doubt.
It turns out. That the missing ingredient was not Arnold, because he was in most of those movies.
Yeah. Right.
The missing ingredient is Sarah Connor.
Yep.
It's Sarah's story. And the thing is, this starts with a different story. It's like a girl in Mexico City who's being hunted by a Terminator. It's a badass new Terminator. She's rescued by somebody else. And then Sarah Connor enters the picture, and her whole life and timeline has changed in a very interesting way. This kind of starts in the very beginning.
Yep.
And she has a new purpose, and she's got sort of a beaten down, like, Sarah Connor in the second one was this sort of very determined. She was beaten down in certain ways, but she was very much a, you know, she was PTSD. She was like, I want to stop the Terminators, and I lost everything I was to become this. And now this is like, she is definitely like just a grizzled old
battled hardened.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she has like her own mystery, which I don't want to reveal too much about.
Yeah.
But she has a mystery that's been keeping her working in a way the last several years or like decade or more, like where she's been doing something that's pretty interesting and kind of cool and weird.
Yeah.
And it has a mystery as to exactly why it's been happening.
How are the action sequences?
Very good. It opens with a.
They're quite good, but I have one sort of somewhat major criticism.
Okay, which is?
They're still too CG for me.
I get that.
They're a little showy in a way that I feel like the Marvel movies figured out how not to do. But if you think about like sort of the big showpiece scenes and like this is a harsh thing, and I don't mean to say it so harshly. You know in Justice League,
oof,
when they're fighting Steppenwolf at the end,
yeah,
and
like
you're
like,
he's CG, and the backgrounds are CG, and all the characters are CG when they're fighting him in midair and stuff?
Yep.
Every once in a while, it gets a little like that.
See, I felt like their new Terminator that's got basically an endoskeleton and liquid metal over it,
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
That is really cool, I also like the protector, too.
That opening chase, I think, is a really pretty spectacular opening chase.
The opening chase is really good, and it was my favorite, and you know why? I think it's because it was most grounded.
I also like Mackenzie Davis plays the protector,
and
she's an enhanced human, not a Terminator.
Who is she?
She's been in a bunch of stuff.
Okay, she's really good.
She's great. Hmm.
She's great at doing the kind of Arnold role, which is to say, well, she does talk, and she's... Well, they say it on the ad. She's a human.
Yeah, she's an enhanced human.
So she is not like a sort of unthinking machine, but she somewhat carries herself with the weight of a Terminator.
Yeah.
She still feels like she's got kind of... She's this physical, protective, and yet dangerous being.
Well, this was in the trailers, and it's in the very first, like, 20 minutes of the movie. There's that fight on the floor of the auto plant.
Yeah.
And she's like... swinging around a sledgehammer like it's nothing and going to town on this guy, and you can see she's a match for the Terminator in some ways.
Yep.
Not the problem is she can't keep going the way a Terminator can because she's human.
Right.
But she can stand up to him and serve as a good protector, and those fights are really good.
Yep. And they also do the scary thing, which I think the first two movies emphasize and needs to almost work for the Terminator movies, which is they are essentially almost horror movies with the Terminator as the slasher and usually Linda Hamilton or whatever as the final girl.
Yeah.
And the notion that you could, like, dish out the level of punishment she does and it's never enough. And not only that, you know it'll never be enough.
Yeah.
So you just have to – you're always fighting, like, a running retreat.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating and kind of scary idea.
One of the things I really like about this is that it is three women on the run. It is the woman who's being hunted, it's the protector, and it's
Sarah.
And I think that's an interesting change in energy.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things like that makes the movie different. I also think that when they bring in Schwarzenegger the way they did it, I feel like I would have liked this movie slightly better if they had not brought him back in.
Yeah.
That said, the way they use him and the way he gets to play this role is different than the way he's played it previously and is a lot of fun.
This is a weird question, but does it fit into sort of continuity of the first two?
Yeah, I would say it does.
Yes, I think so. I think, like, it doesn't fit into the continuity of assuming the rest of them happen, but it's kind of like the new Halloween movie in that sense, where this is clearly a thing that I think some movies are going to start doing, which is they're going to say only the first one or two counted, and this is a sequel to them.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any chance they could pull anything off with Aliens when they do that, but
that'd be nice.
I'm not even going to necessarily worry about it until it happens, because they probably won't.
Wasn't that the talk, though? Weren't they going to do a thing that revealed that Newt and Hicks were still around, and it was going to basically ignore all the other stuff?
That's what it would need, but for me, it's probably too little too late.
Yeah, but I think that is probably not a bad idea.
As instincts go, like, I never thought it would happen that they would be able to ignore the bad later ones. I thought it would always be like kind of like the way Marvel Comics work. You always have to build on it, even if you don't like it.
Yeah.
And so I'm happy to see them doing these kind of things. And Halloween was a lot of fun, the new Halloween. And this was a lot of fun.
Let's see if I can get to the theater.
There's really cool action scenes. I didn't really quite ever know where it was going exactly.
Yep,
and, you know, I have to say, I did like what they did with Arnold, though, even though I kind of agree with you that the dynamic would have been more interesting as it was.
Yeah.
But I like what they did with him, and I like how kind of understated he overall is.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, he kind of somewhat mastered that under James Cameron's direction and had to do that.
Yeah.
But Arnold, as he has aged, has kind of gotten a little bit more larger than life. So I think reining him in as much as they did for this is probably not completely easy. So I think the direction did some good job. Good work with
that. Also, that last, not the final fight, but sort of the mid-big fight is very ambitious.
Yes.
Like, it's on board like a C-130. There's some zero-grav thing going on.
Right, with, like, the plane drop.
Yeah, it's they do some impressive things with the fight sequence.
And this is the director of what, both Deadpools?
Yeah, Tim Miller. Did he direct both?
Yep.
Yeah. His direction's good.
Yep.
Like, it's a solid action movie and a good addition. I'll probably pick this up. I would consider this addition of the canon.
Yeah, and I feel like Terminator fans should check it out.
Yeah.
If you were a little bit nervous or you're like, oh no, it's tanking, it must suck, go see it.
Christian Bale gave me nightmares.
And they're probably never going to do another one after how badly this one tanked, so.
That's too bad.
Yep, so go smoke them while you got them.
Yeah. The other movie Dave and I both saw is Jojo Rabbit.
Right. The very unusual and subversive and audacious and potentially profane movie by Taika Waititi.
Yep.
That is about a little, like, Hitler Youth kid in a stylized kind of... he's going to, like, Hitler Youth camp.
It's Wes Anderson's Hitler Youth.
Yes. It has a... it is darkly comedic throughout. Not quite the way Stanley Kubrick was in... Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a certain kinship with it. Yeah. It's that kind of thing where they're talking about super serious stuff in a kind of absurdist way.
Yeah, well, I mean, Sam Rockwell is amazing in this as this, like, SS camp guy who I think is gay.
Yes, I feel that that is for sure a part of the story.
And he's basically trying to hide from that, and he's like this failure of an Nazi officer.
This seems like heady topics to do sort of satire.
It does, and like Taika Waititi plays JoJo's Imaginary Friend is Hitler.
Right.
Does it ultimately work? Yes. Or is it more kind of like, oh even my god, what am I watching?
No, yeah. Even though I had some issues with it, or it didn't wow me like I kind of wanted to, Clay. I was like, this is very audacious. I like Taika Waititi. I like a lot of what it's doing. But it definitely, I would say, works.
Yeah.
At the very least, it absolutely works.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I'm kind of with Dave. I didn't love this, but I really liked it. And I have to sort of round up my approval because it's not an easy thing to do. To take premise and make it both funny and poignant and also make it work in a way that's not offensive. That's a really tough thing to do, and he pulls that off.
And there may be some people who might argue that it is offensive, but I have not heard those kind of voices.
I haven't either.
I think because the film's the heart is so clearly in the right place, and that there is this tradition. In fact, before we watched it at the Alamo, there was like there's clips of like Hitler being spoofed over the years in movies. Yeah. So obviously Mel Brooks has spoofed him multiple times.
Yep.
But I saw clips from stuff that was in the 1930s and the 1940s, pre-war and like during the war, where he was made out to be this just outrageous buffoon, like with like comical scenes with Mussolini or him falling down in the tub and like just ridiculous stuff. So
okay, I don't want to draw a direct parallel here.
Okay, hit it.
But
that's a fair...
Saturday Night Live...
Yes.
...has had Donald Trump being parodied by Alec Baldwin.
Yep.
And it's funny.
Right.
And it's not like the horrors he's inflicting are not currently going on. I think you can make that work. You can be a buffoon and be funny and also be a horrible person.
Right.
And I think Taika Waititi makes his, like, ghost Hitler likable and funny, but he's also clearly a horrible person. Like, the ultimate realization of that is a very satisfying moment.
Right. And but at the same time, he encourages the kid. He's like, he's like, I've got your back, little guy.
Yeah. And it's weirdly funny.
There's some other supporting characters. I see Scarlett Johansson is quite good as the kid's mom.
She's great.
And there's also, there is a girl who is a Jewish girl who is kind of, I don't want to quite say all the dynamics, but she's kind of being hidden and this kid comes to... have questions about whether he should inform on her.
Right.
And that's also in there.
Also, the friendship between JoJo and his friend.
He's got a best friend.
His young friend. Both those kid actors are great.
Yeah, there's a good dynamic between them. I think we're going to see more of both those kids in future movies. So yeah, even though like I didn't love it, a general recommendation of it.
Because
I think it was, I think it's a project that works.
I agree. Dave, what about Dr. Sleep?
Right, so I'm not going to, like, say too much about this because I think you're going to maybe see it, Randy, and I think you should see it too, Nick.
No, it's something I'm definitely going to go to. We're seeing Charlie's Angels first, and then I'm going to push to go see this.
Nick, have you read the book?
I tried, and this is one of those ones where I've read, like, the first few chapters, and I was like, I'm just not feeling it.
So my brother had the same reaction, and I know that the movie does change things up, but... I saw at least one person say they changed things for the better, but I can see why it would feel a little off-putting because when I went to see the movie, I noticed pretty quickly, and I think I had an inkling of this just from the trailers and from what a few people, one or two advanced reviewers had said, that this was not a straight-up horror movie.
Right.
This was not something that was, like, super scary the way, like, Insidious or something like that is, or The Conjuring. It was a dark fantasy of sorts. And now this is about, again, I'm not going to dive too deep into this, but this is about Danny from The Shining, grown up, having gone through some stuff, and finding that his sort of psychic talent has connects him with a girl and with some people who might be like almost preying on people like them.
Yeah.
And there's a depth of character going on for Danny, for the girl, for the antagonists, and there's a lot of thought that goes into the world. I was intrigued when I read about in the book this notion that Danny kind of ends up, after he sort of pulls himself out of some bad places, that he ends up working at like a hospice, and sort of using his ability to kind of project into people's minds, and his knowledge of sort of the, I guess I'd say, afterlife, to kind of take people quietly to their end, yeah, in sort of a dignified way. And the movie handles, you know, like the movie, and I would hope the book at least, handles that in a really interesting and sort of, I'd say, emotional way. And yet the threat in it becomes interesting and very real. I really liked it. I found it that, so this was directed by Mike Flanagan. He's the showrunner for Haunting of Hill House,
yeah,
on Netflix. He also directed the adaptation of Gerald's Game from Stephen King on Netflix. And I forget what all else is in there. Oh, he directed Oculus, which I didn't love, but had some interesting ideas in
it.
He
seems to have found his footing with Stephen King.
Yeah, I think the fact that King does this character-based horror, and that's what Haunting of Hill House was too.
Yeah.
I think that seems to be the niche he's going to occupy.
It's a good niche.
And it's a good niche.
I forgot until recently you told me this is the guy who did Hill House, which makes me more interested because, yeah, I loved Hill House.
I do think people who like that will probably like this, even though it is pretty different. And there's, like, on the potentially on the negative side, long movie, 2.5 hours.
How is Ewan McGregor?
I thought he was great. I thought he was really good.
He usually
is. In a sort of subtle way.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I wonder if every once in a while I might have seen his accent trying to escape.
I can see that, yeah.
But he's quite good. The whole cast is good, including antagonists. There's some interesting things where you will see flashes of characters from The Shining. And this occupies a weird place, I think, where I know where you're headed, Nick.
Yeah. Because I know that Stephen King hates The Shining.
Right. He has no love for Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. And I always felt it wasn't true to his book. And anybody who's read the book does know it wildly deviates, yep, from it. And I believe this book, this movie, tries to weirdly find a middle ground. It is a sequel to The Shining movie. Yeah. But it incorporates elements of not just, I think, Dr. Sleep, the book, but The Shining, the book, to try and, like, sort of bridge that divide between them. And I'm going to read Dr. Sleep and see what I think. But I think I'd say it succeeds pretty strongly.
You've made me want to watch this movie.
I also want to. Everybody's talking about it and saying how good it is. And the trailer was creepy and effective, so.
You know what? My friend Liz, who I saw it with, I told you how there's like some glimpses of like characters' past. So you're talking about Jack Torrance and his wife from, yeah, The Shining, and, mm-hmm, and some other characters. And they have, to me, it was a best case scenario. They act actors that are sort of lookalikes, similar, huh, but kind of doing their own spin on it. And I thought that they did a very good job. I prefer that to, like, say, highly CG enhanced versions, or like what they did in Rogue One, a full, well, not full CG, but
pretty
something
close
that looks very CG with Leia and,
yeah,
Tarkin.
Yeah.
But Liz was saying she would have preferred that. She wanted them to look exactly like him. So, you know, as a minor heads up, I'll say, A, a little long. B, not quite full-blown horror. C, you might or might not like how they portray the flashbacky stuff. But to me, it really worked, and I was very satisfied with the movie. I felt like, even for 2.5 hours, like, I enjoyed it all. So
I'm going to ask a question.
Yep.
Did you like it better than It, Chapter 2?
Yes.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay. Because I liked It, Chapter 2.
Yeah, no, I immediately thought about that. It's a different kind of movie. Like,
yeah,
it's,
yeah, no, it is.
You know what's interesting is Stephen King's having, I mean, for as long as he's been around,
he's kind of having a renaissance.
He's having
right
a renaissance because, like,
yeah,
also Castle Rock season 2 is going right now, and I started watching that, and that's really good.
And that's the one that's focusing
it's heavily on a young Annie Wilkes.
Yeah,
but there's also some Salem Lot stuff in there.
Interesting.
Oh,
yeah, they're building.
I know, like, Tim Robbins.
They're building a new mall
called
Jerusalem's Lot.
Yeah,
that's
and,
cool.
Yeah, Tim Robbins plays the patriarch of this family between these two war. It's good. I saw like 3 episodes of it. It's good so far.
Okay. We got any other topics?
Yeah. So now is the point.
Sorry, real quick,
yeah,
backtrack. Dr. Sleep, I think, also underperformed at the box office. So
not
I would
as bad
say,
as Terminator, but yes.
Maybe not as bad as Terminator.
I think it's like 20 million or...
But it's to me, it's more deserving than Terminator. So if you've got, if you at least have any love of The Shining or horror or whatever, or Stephen King in general, I'd say catch Dr. Sleep.
What's performing at the box office? Is it something terrible?
I don't remember. Honestly, the talk that I've heard from like podcasts and people in sort of like Hollywood circles is that movie going in general is down, and we're seeing sort of a kind of last gasp of people going to the theaters.
Are you saying movies are dying?
That like is what people. That's
just like just like comics have been dying for 30 years,
right? And that's what people are prophesizing. That's
you know what?
Everyone likes to scream that the sky is falling.
Yeah.
I don't think that is. I think we're dealing with lots of shit in our lives, and we're not escaping our houses as much. That's why streaming services are becoming such a thing.
Makes sense.
That's why movies are going straight to streaming services.
That said, like Joker just became the highest grossing like rated R movie of all time or something.
Right. So that's what's trending.
So that's probably what's trending.
And Marvel movies, I mean, Avengers made $300 billion or whatever the hell it made. I don't know.
All right. So last thing we want to talk about, and there's a spoilers here. Because it's been up for like 12 hours. But we're going to give a spoiler. If you've not seen The Mandalorian and you don't want any spoilers on it, we're going to go ahead and close the podcast out here. Yo, Joe, see you next week. Okay, spoiler warning for Mandalorian. We're going to talk about the first episode.
Yes.
Yep. Dave, you have seen the first half.
Right.
And you probably don't want us to spoil the ending.
I don't mind, actually, because the show didn't grab me.
I already spoiled it a little bit for this morning. So.
I liked it all right.
I don't think any of us loved it.
No, I don't think it's the end all be all. It's not... It's actually not quite what I expected it to be.
I would say I liked what... and I didn't watch this show to completion by any means either, but I liked Rebels, the CG series, better than I liked this.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Mandalorian himself is a tough character. They're doing the Man with No Name thing.
Even more so, well, like, they're doing the Judge Dredd style Man with No Name, which is to say, helmet on the whole time.
Yeah, he talks.
He does talk, but I kind of assumed he would remove the helmet. I mean... Jango Fett removed his helmet.
Yeah.
And you know how good that was?
He wasn't actually a Mandalorian, though.
Exactly.
He was just using the armor.
He was using the armor.
Was that the
name? He's not a Mandalorian.
Technically, Boba Fett is not a Mandalorian either.
Boba Fett's not a Mandalorian either.
What?
Yeah.
I don't know this lore.
Yeah, the Mandalorians. It all shows up in Clone Wars. You should know all this.
Mandalorians are like sort of a battle cult.
I didn't watch all of Clone Wars
either. They're like warrior poet types things, right? There's a little bit of this...
They operate this in like...
samurai element a little bit. Yeah. So basically, this guy is an actual Mandalorian. He's a bounty hunter, but they're like, he's got a small clan of other Mandalorians. There's kids running around wearing helmets.
He's basically collecting bounties to sort of pay his family.
Well, yeah, and it's like he gets something to build a piece onto his armor, and the woman asks him, she's like, have you found your sigil yet or something? There's a little bit of religious iconography to
it. Is that like how, like, oh no, wait, no, I know Boba Fett has that skull like symbol on him, but I saw that
in this.
That's
Mandalorian.
Okay, that's just Mandalorian.
Yeah, it's on his armor.
Yeah.
So some of this is clutch. I mean, Boba Fett didn't have a backstory. He was just like, what if this guy looked cool and was a bounty hunter?
Right.
So they backfilled it. But yeah, I mean, he was wearing Mandalorian armor.
I did like that aspect of it. And the action's great.
The action's really good. I actually kind of like its weird, goofy sense of humor. Like, Star Wars has never been uber serious.
Right.
It makes sense
the
for
goofiness,
it to be a little
goofy. It took me a minute to get past.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. My kid, my 12-year-old, he will not watch something deadly serious.
Right.
And so the having a little bit of the slapsticky stuff that Star Wars has always had kept him engaged for the whole hour.
Interesting.
Even though some of it is quiet. Some of this is kind of a quiet show for him.
Yeah, right. They kind of want, like, you know, they want to let, like, a Western to let some of the scenery and the visuals breathe and to have dramatic images of, like, a solo guy walking across, like, an eerie alien landscape with a gun in his hand in silhouette and stuff like that. Like, there's a little bit of visual flourish to
it. They also want to have big giant face mounts and space walruses.
Yep.
But
it is also a sort of a best of Star Wars where they're utilizing the lore and all the creatures and the droids. Because there's like a Gonk droid and there's a, I don't know what the race is.
There's a Quarren.
Is that the Celestius Crumb?
Oh, the Salacious Crumb is being roasted.
Salacious Crumb is watching his friend.
And making sad noises.
Right. I think probably most of our listeners do know who Salacious Crumb is, but he's Jabba the Hutt's little cackling little shithead sidekick.
Yeah, I was glad to see him roasted.
Yeah, so there was one of them like in a cage watching as another one got turned on a spit.
Yeah.
It's messed up.
But yes, there was IG-88. One of the squid-faced guys.
Yeah.
Pretty sure I saw a Trandoshan, a Bosk.
Yep. Yeah, there were definitely and IG-11.
IG-11.
Assassin Drain, which, that is the best part. Dave, I don't think you got to this.
Nope.
There is an amazing shootout where he and this bounty hunter droid wind up in the same place looking for the same thing, and they decide to split...
I love his dismissiveness of droids in general. Droid bounty hunter. Why the hell are these things even exist?
But, there's a great shootout where the two of them sort of take on this whole army of goons, and it is very much a good, the bad, the ugly kind of thing.
That's pretty cool.
Like, there's no doubt that that's what they were going for.
Yeah.
Wait, he and the droid team up?
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of cool. Yeah, that's like one of the great scenes in Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is when Eli Wallach and Clint Eastwood roam through this town and they like take out like 20 guys.
It's the same. It's totally that.
That's an homage.
That's what it is, yeah.
Okay.
But
there's also a funny runner with this droid self-destruct sequence.
Yes. It is set right after Return of the Jedi.
Yep.
So the Imperials are sort of...
They've been brought low.
So here's a question.
I saw some stormtroopers in there that had, like, dinged up looking messed up armor.
I don't think those are stormtroopers.
You think somebody is just utilizing their armor?
A bunch of dead stormtroopers around, and you pick up their armor, and it's useful armor. I think they're just crime lord guys. But arguably,
their armor isn't so useful. Yeah.
But Werner Herzog was using, like, Imperial branded... Credits and things like that.
I know you're talking about Werner Herzog as an actor, but it kind of makes it sound like he's playing himself.
He's essentially
every role I've seen him in the past couple of years, he's playing himself.
Yeah.
I hope there's more to Carl Weathers, because he was just a little bit as like a guild, the guy giving him assignments. I'm sure there'll be more to that character.
Yeah, I'm sure there will, but Carl Weathers shows up.
I also like the opening bit in the bar where he like takes on several guys.
Yep.
Where somebody shoots his armor. And he shoots back, like the armor absorbs the hit. Armor never absorbs anything in Star Wars. It's just
true.
It just doesn't work.
Well, they actually like is that real? I forget what
they call
kind
it something
of metal.
Well, yeah, steel.
Yeah,
kind of steel. Yeah, Beskar steel.
Yes.
And it's clearly supposed to be like the impressive metal armor. So
because right off the bat, you know that Mandalorian means business when he's like taking out people left and right.
The tail end reveal of who he's after.
Was really cool, actually.
I didn't see that coming. Here's the thing. I remembered about halfway through when he's, like, sent off this weird bounty. I'm like, wait, wasn't there supposed to be some kind of kid in this? Wasn't this supposed to be a lone wolf and cub type thing? And I remembered that. So I was expecting there to be a kid, that's what he was after. I was not expecting what we got.
What is the name of that race?
We don't know the name of that race. I don't think anybody's ever seen... I don't think we've seen any other...
Okay, has it not?
Race. No.
Interesting.
No. So I think that's really interesting, and I'm assuming that it has something to do with... people hunting Jedi, essentially.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see where they go from here. I will definitely watch more.
Oh, yeah. Production value's high.
Yeah.
It felt like Star Wars.
It felt like Star Wars.
And that's all you really can hope for from a show like this.
Yeah. It is
I could hope for more.
Yeah. I would have liked to have been, like, challenging Watchmen for my favorite show or anything right now. And it's not that.
What I wanted from this that I didn't feel like I got, and I do, I'll probably want to finish watching the first episode so I can give it its fair shake, but showrunner...
Jon Favreau.
In movies like Iron Man or even... like Elf or the Jungle Book and stuff like that he's done. I love watching his characters interact in like the sandboxes he creates. And I wasn't quite sure if he's kind of this sort of quieter man with no name seriousness. There's some comedy, but like it doesn't kind of come from the lead character.
I feel like all the character stuff got sanded down a little bit. I feel like probably this was so looked at and tinkered with by the Disney higher-ups because it's so important.
But we know that there are other characters coming.
Yeah.
But
Dave's point, I think, is a good one. Is that a man with no name type, the central character who we know is the one who's going to be in every episode, that's not Favreau's strength.
Right. I kind of want to see what they do with it. I think they deserve to tell their arcs and stuff like that. And I know that Favreau's a talent and there's other good people working on the show. But I think it may not quite be for me. And I think part of it is, like, I don't think I ever wanted to... I wasn't particularly interested in seeing a Mandalorian show.
Yeah.
So that's kind of on me.
I'll definitely be tuning in for another episode.
I'll be tuning into Disney Plus in general because it's pretty good so
far. There's a flood of stuff on there. Yeah, we'll probably be having new stuff. We'll be showing in the store maybe if one of us puts our login into the system.
Yep, that's true. Sure.
All right, that'll do it for us. Until next week.
Yo show.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.